AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the spring of 1989, Beijing, Tiananmen Square, a gathering of students that grows over several weeks, anticipating and then observing the visit of the leader of the Soviet Union, a man named Gorbachev, making a call on the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing, the CCP itself, led by a man named Deng Xiaoping. That meeting is a world-scale event. Events in Europe have been changing the direction of communism, Marxist-Leninism, and the TV cameras are invited into Beijing during that period of conversation, in some fashion an alliance of two communist states that are changing their ways. Deng Xiaoping is seen as a reformer. Mikhail Gorbachev is seen as a reformer. And gathering in the square are also TV reporters and radio reporters from around the world. In other words, all attention. And then there's the death of a man named Yao Bang, Hu Yao Bang. His death leads to outpouring of sympathy across the nation because he was seen as a reformer or a lighter hand of the brutality that the people of China have visited. This event does not begin, but it ends. A new book, To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. I welcome Professor Sean McMeekin. He's done an enormous amount of work putting this all together. And because I've read pieces of this over the years in individual books, it is a great insight to put it all together and to make you read it continuously, not only at Tiananmen Square, which is still banned, or any reference to Tiananmen Square is banned, or throughout the world, as far as I can see, that has any presence of the Chinese Communist Party whatsoever. But Tiananmen is what Marxist-Leninism, communism, Maoism has not explained. What does Tiananmen mean, the massacre that happened on the night of June 4th, 1989? Professor, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. I congratulate you enormously on this work. What does Tiananmen mean now to those who were once communists in Russia and those who claim to be Maoist communists in China? Do they speak of it anywhere, or is it completely banished from their memories? Good evening to you.
Well, thank you for having me on, John. It's great to be back on the air with you again. What does Tiananmen mean? I suppose Chinese dissidents certainly know what it means. I think in China, as you suggest, it's really not spoken of at all. What it means is the same thing, I suppose, that Kronstadt used to mean in interwar Europe when people were talking about the true legacy of communism, that is a government basically firing into the crowds. And in the case of Kronstadt, not entirely unlike Tiananmen, you had the government killing a lot of the people that it ostensibly, of course, was serving. In the case of Kronstadt, it was more a matter of working classes, factory workers, some sailors, some soldiers. In the case of Tiananmen Square, I suppose it was perhaps a bit more prominently constituted of students. But they were certainly proletarians in you might say, in the imagery or the mythology of the regime. The masses were there. Supposedly calling for some variety of democracy, some variety of people's rule, which of course communist parties claimed to do some variety of. It was either people's democracy or was rule in the name of the people, or at least the proletarians, or a dictatorship of the proletariat. Effectively, Tiananmen is the tearing off of the mask. You can't really pretend after Tiananmen Square that the regime exists on any basis of popular sovereignty, on any basis of the consent of the governed to its rule. You have the unmasking, of course, of raw force, of brutality, of political violence, which really is at the essence of the communist project.
Karl Marx, born 1918, died 1883. Go back to the beginning of this idea of communism, because it's the Communist Manifesto that becomes part of the conversation over these century and a half that communism has been first avant-garde, then trendy, then persuasive, and then brutality and mystery. Karl Marx was born in Prussia, so he's born a Prussian. He comes from a family that does not practice its Judaism. He early on, I'm following Sean's reporting, University of Bonn, University of Berlin, University of Vienna. He early on reads Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Saint-Simon, Fourier, the French socialists, and he moves from Germany to Cologne to Paris, and in the course of his life, he'll eventually live in London. But Karl Marx was a Hegelian, and it's important to understand that when you get phrases that are persuasive, I learned from Sean, such as "you only about the proletariat," or "there's the world is divided between the oppressors and the oppressed." That's Hegelianism. What did it mean to Karl Marx? How did he interpret Hegel, the great German philosopher that was useful for him in creating the Communist Manifesto and then also writing Das Kapital?
Well, from Hegel, Marx, like a lot of the so-called left Hegelians, there were some who were more the center on the right, but the left Hegelians drew from Hegel the idea of history as the product of this incessant struggle, a kind of binary struggle. In Hegel's vision, it was about a progression towards some final, perhaps, almost something like a Fukuyama, that is, with progress towards the modern nation state with secular values, but overlain with a kind of Christian morality, which helped to keep everyone to some extent on a moral plane. He basically thought things were getting better. He was something of an optimist, that the world might end in some variety of what might later be called Western liberal democracy. The left Hegelians were a bit darker, or perhaps you might say more cynical. They did see history as a process of struggle, of opposition, in the old phrase, thesis against antithesis forming a synthesis. This is the essence of the dialectic, as the Marxists would later call it. History is the course of these struggles. Marx tried to reduce it to a binary struggle, which he called class struggle. He could never quite simplify it that far. If you actually read his writings, there are all kinds of different classes, but ultimately he wants them all to melt together into these two. You have oppressors and oppressed. You have the capitalists and the proletariat, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Inevitably, history is supposed to be simplified into this kind of binary dialectical cataclysm. But the way Marx is actually describing it, what's interesting is, of course, although he is reading a little bit of history and eventually he does study a bit of economics, he really is predominantly a philosopher. So that for him, it's something like, it's almost like a word game. It's an abstract word game. At one point, he actually defines communism as the negation of the negation. That is, he's trying to solve this puzzle that Hegel posed for his students, the riddle of history solved, trying to figure out the ultimate process that could explain everything, the kind of theory of history. And so Marx came up with this theory, basically, that history was all produced by class struggle. So supposedly since the French Revolution, everything had been reduced. You no longer had the feudal period. You no longer had the varieties of hierarchy and aristocracy and monarchy, but eventually you would just have the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. And when he outlined this in the Manifesto of the Communist Party in 1848, he also predicted or produced, I mean, it's a little bit more advocacy, I think, than it is prophecy, although it's meant to be prophecy, the idea that eventually you would get this final cataclysm and the workers of the world would unite, as the phrase would have it, realizing that they all shared the same oppressor, that all the various other identities, national identities, ethnic identities, class, or even family, and even family, of course, would be basically dissolved in this struggle into the final binary cataclysmic clash between capital and the proletariat, or the bourgeois and the proletariat. So he's really getting this from philosophy. I mean, eventually he does decorate his account with bits and pieces that he picked up from reading the history, particularly of the French Revolution. Later on, when he was in England, he would decorate it with various data when he was writing Das Kapital, which is meant to be almost like a work of economic theory or economic history. But it really is ultimately a philosophical project, so that in the end, Marx is something of a wordsmith. He's very good with words. So he would come up with these phrases, the integument of private property bursts asunder, the expropriators are expropriated. These very, very striking phrases, workers of the world unite, workers have no homeland. They're very striking. They're very memorable. Eventually, they produce almost a kind of a rhythmic catechism. But in the end, I think it's really far more philosophy than it really is any type of serious political economy.
Violence is needed here. And when we come back, the Paris Commune of 1871, what does it mean for Karl Marx and for those who will follow his writings for the balance of the 19th century, for the whole of the 20th century, and well into the 21st so far? Sean McMeekin, Professor Sean McMeekin, the new book is To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. I'm John Batchelor.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.